Eager to share, he proceeded to tell her far more than she thought she needed to know, all while leaving her wondering the reason for his call. His dad was doing pretty well, he told her, but he'd become such a worrier ever since his wife died. He couldn't stop checking in on everyone all the time. He called his parents at least 3 times a week, far more than the weekly calls they'd become accustomed to. He emailed Vince at least every other day to learn about the latest places Vince had visited and to make sure he hadn't run out of money. He called multiple times a day to check on Mighty, though Anna and Stacy and the part-time chauffeur repeatedly assured him that Mighty was fine and promised him that nothing bad was going to happen on their watch. "It's hard, as a parent, not to think about your child all the time," Nanny said. "Sure," Vince said, but it was really strange how his dad had suddenly become a man who made his life revolve around family. It would even be funny if it wasn't so sad. He appeared to hold nothing dearer than Mighty's well-being, rescheduling meetings to attend Mighty's hockey practices, turning down invitations to parties and dinners so he could stay home and play video games with Mighty, writing poems for Mighty while the boy slept. "I called him the other day, and he's coming back from taking a cooking class," Vince said with a laugh. "He wants to learn how to cook the meals my mom used to make for Mighty."
"I'm so happy to hear this for Mighty's sake," Nanny said. "I'm sure you know more than me, but that child wanted nothing more than to spend time with his father."
"Yeah, I'm glad for Mighty, but it's pretty sad whenever I talk to my dad about his day. He seems to be learning quickly and holding it together well, but the universe has thrown him this heavy curveball, and he's struggling to carry it and walk on his path. And at his age, he still hasn't figured out his path, which is what happens when you go off pursuing illusions.
For a man to raise a child alone, it's not easy. Us women, it's in our blood."
"It's definitely not in his blood, I'll tell you that. But I'm proud of him, how he's coping and doing his best."
"You should tell him that, Vince. It will make him happy. What would make a parent happier than to hear their child say, 'I'm proud of you'?"
"I've told him how grateful I am that Mighty's doing well, and it's all thanks to him." Nanny nodded, but said nothing. "It's going to be a long road for him," Vince continued. "But he seems to have learned the importance of balance and recognizing that..."
"But Mighty," Nanny said, "he must still be struggling to understand."
"Yeah. The good days are good, and once in a while, he has a bad day when he doesn't want to do anything, and poor Dad has no clue what to do. But overall, I'll say he's much happier than I thought he would be, and he gets to have something I never had. I was very worried for him when I left after the funeral."
"You left right after the funeral?"
"No, I stayed for over a month, but when I came back here, I thought about returning home a lot."
"You? Returning? Don't you hate America?"
Vince laughed. "I don't love America," he said, "but my family's there, so I have to find a way to at least be able to stomach it."
"I still don't understand what is hard for you to stomach."
"All the bullshit the masses are blind to. So much mindlessness. People sit on their couches and watch garbage interrupted by messages to buy garbage, which will create a desire for more garbage. They go to their computers and order from incredibly horrible corporations that are enslaving their fellow humans and pretty much destroying any chance of children growing up in a world where they can be truly free. But hey, we have our material comforts, and we're saving money, and corporations are creating 60-hour-a-week jobs with sick leave, so what does it matter if we're complicit? Let's just carry on with our lives while our country continues to commit atrocities all over the world."
"You want to give me your American citizenship and take my Cameroonian citizenship?"
Nanny said, laughing. Vince did not laugh. "Anyway," he said, "now that Mighty and my dad are mostly okay, I'm probably never coming back for good. Maybe I'll visit once a year. I don't know."
"Once or twice a year will be good for all of you."
"Maybe. I had a really hard time saying goodbye to them after the funeral."
"I cannot even imagine," Nanny said. I am so sorry about everything that happened, Vince. Truly sorry. I wanted to email to tell you that the news made me very sad, but I couldn't even...
Don't worry about it. I know it wouldn't have been an easy email to write.
No, it wasn't only that. I know how much you and your mother used to be really tight. Mighty told me that one time the two of you went on a vacation without him.
It's true, Vince said with a laugh. We went to Fiji the summer before I started college.
I have heard of Fiji. Was it nice?
We had a blast, snorkeling and scuba diving every day and feasting on some crazy delicious seafood at night. Pretty much living right in the ocean.
That sounds like a very nice vacation.
It was awesome. I remember one morning, this guy on the beach tried to hit on my mom, and I came over and pretended she was my girlfriend. It was hilarious. He chuckled. My mom used to be pretty cool. For a moment, neither of them said anything.
But what really happened between the two of you?
Nanny asked. Vince did not immediately respond. She stayed the same, and I became a different person, he said. I guess that's the long and short of it.
You miss her?
Yeah. But what can we do in life but accept?
I don't know, Vince. You like to talk about this acceptance thing, but it's just not easy to accept when bad things happen.
I don't care what anyone says. All those people who walk around saying they accept their life as it is, I don't know how they do it. I can't even believe how much I think about home these days. Obviously it has to do with my mom not being around, but when I came back here that first week, I called home way more than I promised myself I ever would.
Because you felt sorry for Mighty?
Yeah. I couldn't imagine what his life would be like, you know? My mom gone, my dad working all the time. Even if Mighty has my mom's friends and Stacy and Anna, I knew it wouldn't be the same.
Only your mother can love you a certain way.
Maybe. But the universe gives us different sources of love to unite us all as one. Who are we to decide what the source of our love should be at any given time? Love is love. And at any given point, we have everything we need. Though, I must admit, Mighty does not like spending time with my mom's friends as much as he did with you and Jende.
Maybe if they give him fried ripe plantains and puff puff, he will like them more.
Then he said, and they both laughed. Actually, Vince said, his voice turning serious, that's what I'm calling you about.
About fried ripe plantains and puff puff?
No, he replied with a little laugh. About Mighty.
You know I'll do anything that I can do for you two, so please ask me.
Thing is, Vince said, Stacy is moving to Portland, and we need a new nanny for Mighty.
Okay.
I spoke to my dad a couple of days ago about it. He was going to call an agency to find someone else, but I thought about you, and we both agreed you'd be ideal for the job.
But I'm not looking for a job,
Nanny hastily replied. I know. We're not asking you to take a full-time job. It would be awesome if you could do it full-time, but I imagine with two kids, you don't want to work full-time right now.
I don't.
I get it. It's totally cool. If you can't do it full-time, we can make it work another way. We'll get Mighty someone else full-time, and you'll only need to spend time with him a few hours a week.
Like how many hours?
Whatever works for you and my dad and Mighty.
I'm still confused. You don't think one nanny is enough for Mighty?
No, that's not the thing. Okay, here's the thing. We think it'll be good for him to have some kind of constant, nurturing mother figure in his life.
Nanny said nothing.
His grief counselor agrees it might help him with his healing. He's a kid. He needs it. Not someone to replace my mom. No one can do that, of course. Just a woman he loves, and who he knows loves him very much, too.
But what about your father's sister? Nanny asked. Or your mother's friends?
My aunt's in Seattle, and my mom's friends, don't get me wrong, they have their virtues, but it's not the same thing. It just isn't. You two had a special connection, and my dad and I... We really wouldn't mind paying you, even if it's just to take Mighty and Leomi to dinner every so often, or bring him up to Harlem and give him an evening like the one we had that night.
You told your dad about that night?
I did. Only recently, though.
And he wasn't angry?
No. Funny, but he was really glad we got to have the experience.
Nanny nodded, but did not say anything.
You don't have to decide right now, Vince said. Maybe think about it for a couple of days, talk it over with Jende, and I'll call you next week. Does that sound good?
Nanny shook her head. She couldn't tell Vince it sounded good because she didn't need a couple of days to decide. Even before Vince was done explaining, she knew what her answer would be. No, she couldn't do it.
The judge's decision was coming any day now, which meant that her days in America were most likely numbered. Jende was confident the judge would grant the request. So confident, in fact, that he had started searching for airline tickets and had asked her 2 nights ago how much she thought their bed would go for on Craigslist. Even if the judge denied the request, or Jende decided to withdraw the petition for whatever reason, she still wouldn't take the job, because she couldn't do such a thing to a dead woman. Mighty was Cindy's baby, and Cindy had gone to her grave hating her. How could she, in good conscience, look Mighty in the eye after what she'd done to his mother? How would Vince feel if Anna ever told him what she had witnessed? She hadn't killed Cindy, but maybe she had, and it wouldn't ever be right to walk back into Cindy's home, no matter how much she cared about Mighty. She knew that when she died, her soul would never find peace if her enemy shamelessly walked into her home and took over her place in her children's life.
Chapter 56. He found out on a Friday afternoon. The judge had granted his request for voluntary departure.
"You've got to leave by the end of September," Boubacar told him. "September 30th, he says. He was going to give you 120 days to leave, but...
It's no problem, Mr. Boubacar," Jende said, grinning his Great Rift Valley-wide grin. "I am ready."
"I don't know what happened. He changed his mind. You only got 90 days now."
Jende moved to the edge of the park bench to make room for a man in a purple suit.
90 days is fine, Mr. Boubacar," he said. "Truly, I don't need any more time."
"Good. I know it's too fast, but I can't do anything about it, my brother. I'm sorry."
"No, please don't worry for me, Mr. Boubacar. I saw an advertisement for good tickets on Air Maroc. The price was so good, I bought our tickets for the day they gave me the cheapest price. We are leaving in August."
"Huh? You are really ready to leave, eh?"
"When you told me last week that you were 99.99% sure the judge was going to approve my request, I just started looking for tickets. I even bought a new suitcase yesterday," he laughed.
"I'm happy to hear you sound so happy, my brother," Boubacar said. "Some people, when they buy the ticket, they cry until the day they enter the plane."
"But what can I do, Mr. Boubacar? My people say if God cuts off your fingers, he will teach you how to eat with your toes."
"Abi, if I was a Christian, I would say amen to that."
"And how is the madame? Is she as happy to go back home as you are?"
Jende chuckled. "She is not happy," he said. "But she is packing up."
"Just make sure she doesn't spend all your money buying things," Boubacar warned. "Because women, you have to be careful with them and all the things they say they must have before they go back home. Anything that makes them look good is a necessity."
"Too late, oh, Mr. Boubacar," Jende said, laughing. "It's already too late."
He'd given Nani more money for shopping than he'd intended. Doing so was the only thing that had made her smile in days. Him telling her she could spend $500 buying whatever she wanted to buy. She'd ended up spending $800 buying things not easily found back in Limbe. Dollar store toys for the children, so they wouldn't have to play with mud and sticks. Foods in jars, and all the sweet cereals Leomi had become accustomed to. Clothes for as many years into the future as they would need in order to preserve their American aura. For herself, she bought beauty creams and anti-aging moisturizers in Chinatown, concoctions she hoped would preserve her beauty and youth for a long time, and keep her elevated in looks among the women back home. News had reached her that loose young women were now aplenty in Limbe, good-looking and shameless wolowos women who made wives nervous. Sure, Jende was a man of little lust, never once looking at even the largest cleavage, not in her presence at least, in all their married life. But she'd also never had to worry about another woman trying to steal him. Why would any woman try to lure him away when there were thousands of men in New York City with more money? But in Limbe, it would no longer be so. The loose young women there would be eager to pounce on him. He would no longer be a poor boy from a Karabot house in Newtown, but a man who had returned from America with a lot of dollars. Those Wolowos girls would be all over him, giggling and exposing their teeth, saying things like, "Mr. Jende, how now? You look good, oh." She would have to give him no reason to move his eyes sideways, especially now that she didn't have the assets those young women had. She would never look like them again, because motherhood had squeezed out the appeal from her breasts and drawn lines of exhaustion on her belly. Her body was no longer a marvel, thus her best weapon in the battle for her husband's eyes wouldn't be her nakedness, but her glowing, spot and wrinkle-free face, and the clothes and accessories she would put on the body from which she plans to lose 5 pounds in the coming month. She had to return to Limbe prepared.
"Don't forget the girls in your country. They're gonna rub fine American cream, too,"
Fatou said, when Nani went across the street to her apartment to give her a purse she'd bought for her as a belated birthday gift, and told her how prepared she was to fight to keep her marriage strong.
"They know how to buy cream and spray perfume, too, and look like an American woman. They go near him," Nani said. "I'll kill them."
Fatou looked at Nani's wide, determined eyes and laughed.
"I'm not gonna ever get that kind of problem," she said. "No woman gonna try to steal my Usman. Who want Usman with his leg like a broomstick? No woman. So I keep him."
Nani laughed. For a minute, in a good friend's presence, she forgot how fearful she was about her future and laughed. Having a man other women wanted was a curse masquerading as a blessing, she told herself. But it was a source of pride nonetheless. Jende was going to be somebody in Limbe when they returned. He was going to be a businessman. He would get a nice brick house for them in Sokolo or Batoke or Mile 4, and she would have a maid. Over dinner at Red Lobster on a Sunday evening, while Winston and Mami watched the kids, he had told her all that.
"I promise you, with all my heart and soul, baby," he had said to her, "you will live like a queen in Limbe."
She had fidgeted with her food, unwilling to look into his eyes.
"What can I do now?" she said to him. "We have to go whether I want it or not."
"Yes, baby, but I want you to come back happy. I don't want you to come back crying the way you've been crying.
I don't like to see you cry like this, eh? I don't like it at all."
He pursed his lips and made a childish, sad face, which made her laugh.
"I love New York so much, Chance," she said. "I'm so happy here. I don't even know how to..."
He took her hands and kissed them the way he had seen the leading men do in movies. After paying for their food, they walked to Times Square, one of his favorite places in the city. Before Nani came to America, Times Square was his second substitute best friend, after Columbus Circle, a place that never failed to remind him of what he'd left behind. Being there was like being at Half Mile Junction in Limbe.
where billboards for Ovaltine and Guinness towered above dusty streets. Cab drivers honked and swore at impudent pedestrians. Drinking spots stayed open virtually all night every weekend. Voluptuous prostitutes cursed loudly at tight-fisted patrons, and the noise never died. At the center of the square, right at the corner of Broadway and 42nd, Jende and Nenny stood side by side and held on to the moment. There would be no Times Square in Limbe, Nenny thought. No billboards flashing things she wished she had the money to buy. There'd be no McDonald's where she could enjoy her beloved McNuggets. No people of too many colors speaking too many languages, running around to thousands of fun places. There would be no pharmacy career. No condo in Yonkers or Mount Vernon or New Rochelle. She buried her face in his shoulder and begged herself to be happy. Chapter 57. In Limbe, the $10,000 Nenny had taken from Cindy, plus the $8,000 they'd saved, $5,000 from diligently putting away approximately $350 every month during the 14 months Jende had worked for the Edwardses, $3,000 from the 4 weeks Nenny had worked for Cindy, would make them millionaires many times over. Even after buying their airline tickets and making all the necessary purchases, they would have enough money for Jende to become one of the richest men in Newtown. With the new exchange rate at 600 CFA francs to a dollar, he would be returning home with close to 10 million CFA francs, enough to restart their life in a beautiful rental with a garage for his car and a maid so his wife could feel like a queen. He would have enough to start a business, which would enable him to someday build a spacious brick house and send Leomi to Baptist High School, Buea, the boarding school Winston had attended, because his late father came from a wealthy Bonso clan, the school Jende could not attend because Pajonga could not afford it. Without any treatment, his back stopped aching. A month before he was to leave, Winston called with an idea. Would Jende be willing to manage the construction of a new hotel Winston and one of his friends were building at Seme Beach, and then become the hotel manager when it was completed?
"We'll talk about salary, Bo," Winston said. "We'll pay you good money, more than what you used to make as a laborer at Limbe Urban Council."
Jende laughed and promised to think about it. 2 days later, when Winston stopped by for a visit, Jende declined the offer. He was appreciative of his cousin's help, but he wanted to run his own business, get to know what it was like to answer to no man. All his life, it had been yes, sir, yes, madame. A time had to come for him to stand above others and hear yes, Mr. Jonga. Upon his return to Limbe, he would start his own business, Jonga Enterprises. His slogan would be, "Jonga Enterprises, bringing the wisdom of Wall Street to Limbe." He would diversify and conglomerate and acquire as many competitors as possible. But he'd have to start small. Maybe he'd own a couple of taxis or Benskins, or hire people to farm the 8 acres of land his father had left for him in Bimbia. He could sell the food in the Limbe market and ship some of it abroad. Winston encouraged him to move forward with the farming idea first. There were enough taxis in Limbe, and Benskins, with their high accident rates, which had left many swearing that motorcycles were the devil's creations, were bound to fall out of favor with the public soon enough. But food, Winston said, would always be needed.
"Food," Jende agreed, "and drinking spots." "Will people in Limbe ever get tired of drinking?" Winston said. "I hear drinking spots are opening all over town like no man's business. They say there's even a spot that sells Heineken and Budweiser." "Heineken and Budweiser? In Cameroon?"
Jende leaned forward on the sofa to rock the bassinet in which Timba was lying belly up and on the verge of fussing. Winston stood up and peered at the baby. He smiled at her, tickled her belly, cooed in response to her toothless grin, and returned to the sofa.
"That's how you know this American domination has gone too far, Bo," Winston said. "Paysans have gone from wanting Guinness and 33 Export to wanting Budweiser and Heineken."
"And Motorola Razor," Jende said. "My mother asked me to bring back a razor for her.
so she can have the nicest phone among all her friends who she goes to farm with. Don't ask me why she takes her cell phone to the farm. There's no network there. She saw a razor in a Nigerian movie. She wants it. Why should she be left behind in the 20th century?
I told Neni, Jende went on. I said, maybe you won't even miss New York too much because Limbe now has so many things New York has. But no, she doesn't listen. She continues walking around the house with a long face like something whose name I can't even remember right now.
Ah, Bo, please, have a bit of sympathy for her. It's not easy for her to be.
But isn't it true? Everything she sees here, she's going to see in Limbe. The girls in Limbe now, I hear they all look like Beyonce. And no one wants to drink country mimbo anymore. Palm wine is falling out of fashion. Everyone is American or European now. Emmanuel told me a club in West End even sells Cristal glass by glass.
You are serious?
I'm serious. Victor owns the club. You remember Victor?
Which Victor?
Winston asked.
The one we used to play football against in the Interquarter League? The one who lives behind the Catholic Church and has those buttocks like a woman's?
That one, Jende said. Emmanuel swears the club is helele.
How did he come up with the capital?
You didn't hear the story. The boy went to Bulgaria. Bulgaria or Russia or Australia, somewhere over there. Boy comes back with some serious colo. Rumor all over town is that he was a dancer. Who knows what kind of dance he did? From the kind of money he brought back, he must have done it very well.
A black man shaking it for white women, Winston said. Isn't that what they want? And Victor could shake it, let me tell you.
I'll never forget the time I was dancing toward this fine nga at Black and White. I think it was a Christmas day. The music was booming, man. I was moving it, ready to pounce and make my move.
He stood up and gyrated his hips to show the Makossa moves of his younger days. Jende watched him, smiling.
Then,
Winston said and paused, his hands spread out.
Out of nowhere, Victor comes out and does this Michael Jackson move, and the Nga starts laughing. I think it was Thriller, because that boy was doing some serious vibrations. The Nga is laughing and laughing, and the next thing I know, wait, where is she? The bastard stole the Nga with his Michael Jackson moves, right in front of me. I stood there in the middle of that nightclub, high and dry.
Jende laughed until he fully doubled over, gasping for air.
Ah, Limbe, he said. I cannot believe I will be there again.
Just don't become an American wonder when you go back,
Winston said, laughing as he sat down.
Play it mature, please. That's all I ask of you.
Jende shook his head. He would never become an American wonder, one of those mbutukus who went to America and upon their return home spoke with laughable American accents, spraying wannas and gunnas all over sentences. They strutted around town wearing suits and cowboy boots and baseball caps, claiming to understand very little of Cameroonian culture because they were now too American. Come and see American Wonder, the song about them went. Come and see American Wonder. Do you know American Wonder? Come and see American Wonder. He would never be laughable. He would be respectable. Later that evening, after Neni and Leomi had returned home from buying Leomi new sneakers, Jende told Neni the idea of wholesaling food. She kept her head down, saying nothing as she unpacked the sneakers and put them inside a Ganamus Go bag.
Maybe we can even find a way to export some of the food over here, he said. Maybe sell in African stores here?
What do you need my opinion for?
She said, lifting her head to look at him as if he disgusted her.
Aren't you the knower of everything?
Her eyes seemed ready to tear through him like a sharp knife slicing pork belly. It had been less than a week since their moment in Times Square, and she was back to despising him for taking her and her children away from America.
But, baby, he said, I just thought you'd like to know.
Why? No, please, don't ask me anything. Just do whatever you want to do, okay? Whatever you want, however you want it, just do it. You don't need to ask me.
Thankfully, Leomi was back to wanting to grow up to be like him, so after Neni shut the bedroom door saying she wanted to finish her work in peace and quiet, Jende went into the living room, where he and his son roughhoused on the floor and tickled each other so hard they both gasped for air. He called his brother Moto the next day and asked him to begin the search for men to till the land in Bimbia and plant plantains, egusi, and yams. He also asked him to be on the lookout for a 3-bedroom brick house with a garage, as well as a maid and a temporary car he would drive until the used Hyundai he had purchased at a New Jersey state auction arrived in a shipping container. 3 days later, his brother texted to say he had found a house for rent in Coconut Island, as well as a car, a 1998 Pajero. He would have the house furnished with basic necessities and a housemaid hired by the time the family arrived.
Look you,
Fatou said when Neni told her about the house and the maid.
You gonna leave small one room and go stay for mansion. Why Usman no do this for me too?
So ask Usman to take you back home then, Neni retorted.
Usman no won't go back home,
Fatou said. She paused and looked at the empty luggage lying on the living room floor.
If only me, I'll go back. I'll go to my village, build house near my mother and father. I live quiet life, die quiet die. If only me, I'll go home. Très bientôt.
Neni watched the perpetual sparkle in Fatou's eyes dim as she said this, and she knew her friend was serious. For the first time that afternoon, she did not mean what she was saying as a joke. Fatou missed her parents, especially now that they were in their 80s and needed her and her 2 brothers to take care of them. She and her brothers worried about them, but there wasn't much they could do from far away. One of her brothers was in France, the other in Oklahoma. Her parents had to depend on distant relatives to take care of them using the money transfers Fatou and her brothers sent every few months. They had to live like people who had never borne children, which shamed Fatou every time she got a call from a relative saying one of them had fallen sick and money was needed to take them to a hospital. Fatou always sent the money within a day, even when she had a bill due. What else could she do? After 26 years, she was ready to stop braiding hair for a living and go back home. But the decision wasn't hers alone to make. And even if Usman wanted to go back home, her children were Americans who had never been to their parents' homeland. All 7 of them, the 3 in their 20s and 4 teenagers, wanted nothing of living in West Africa. Some of them didn't even consider themselves African. When people asked where they were from, they often said, "Oh, we're from right here, New York, America." They said it with pride, believing it. Only when prodded did they reluctantly admit that, well, actually, our parents are Africans. "But we're Americans," they always added, which hurt Fatou and made her wonder. Was it possible her children thought they were better than her? Because they were Americans and she was African? Chapter 58. The Bakweri people of Limbe believe August is a cursed month. The rains fall too hard and for too long. Rivers rise up too high and too fast. Dry days are few. Chilly nights are many. The month is long, dreary, and hostile. And it is for this reason that many in the tribe do not marry, build houses, or start businesses in August. They wait for it to go away, along with its curses. Jende Jonga, a Bakweri man, believed nothing in curses. August or no August, it was time for him to go back home, and that was that. Walking through the streets of New York during his last days in America, he couldn't bring himself to feel sad about leaving or wish his experience were ending differently. Enough was enough. He wanted no more of life in a roach-filled apartment in a Harlem neighborhood of fried chicken joints, storefront churches, and funeral homes where young men in cornrows and saggy pants perpetually lingered outside, mourning one of their own and carelessly spitting in his direction. He wanted no more of climbing 5 flights of stairs to share a bed with his daughter while his son slept in a cot inches away. He wanted no more of smiling for appearances as he stacked dishes and polished silverware. And he certainly wanted no more of riding the subway from work late at night, arriving home sweaty, greasy, and drained. To him, living such a life for another year would have been the curse. Not recognizing when to go back home would have been the curse. Not realizing that he would be happier sleeping in a bedroom separate from his children, going to visit his mother and his brothers whenever he wanted, meeting his friends at a bukaru in Down Beach for roasted fish and beer by the ocean, riding around in his own car and sweating outside in January. That would have been the curse. "You're really sure you're not going to miss America?" his friends at work asked him repeatedly. "Not even the football?" He laughed every time they asked. "Maybe a bit of football," he would reply, "and cheesecake." Neni, for her part, could summon no joy as the date of their departure drew close. Her tears flowed without provocation on the subway, at Pathmark, in Central Park, in the apartment in the middle of mundane chores. She felt no excitement at the thought of being reunited with her family and old friends, only apprehension at the notion that she might never be happy in Limbe as she'd been in New York. She worried that she might have too little in common with her friends, being that she was now so different from them, being that she had tasted a different kind of life and been transformed positively and negatively in so many different ways, being that life had expanded and contracted her in ways they could never imagine. Though she looked forward to seeing her mother and siblings, she dreaded seeing her father, whom she'd last spoken to in May, when he'd called to tell her that his illegitimate son who lived in Potapota quarters was in the hospital, and money was needed for medicine. Neni had said they had no money to give, and her father had yelled at her. "How can you say you have no money when your brother is dying in the hospital?" he'd said. "But he's not my brother," Neni had yelled back. Her father had hung up when she said that, and she hadn't bothered to call back to find out how the boy was faring. The boy wasn't her brother, and he was never going to be her brother. She couldn't bring herself to care if he lived or died. For her children, Neni wavered between joy and sorrow. Joy for the beautiful things Cameroon would give them, sorrow for the things it wouldn't. They would grow up in a spacious house in Limbe, learn to speak French, master how to dance to Makossa music. They would live near doting grandparents and too many uncles and aunts and cousins. They would dress up in their finest outfits on Christmas and New Year's and walk around town with their friends, laughing and eating chin-chin and cake. They'd never wonder why their mother preferred to shop at the dollar store, or why their father seemed to always be working. Leomi would go to BHS Buea with the children of the elite. He could still become a lawyer like his uncle Winston. Timba would spend her girlhood dancing under the moonlight with her friends, singing Gombe, Gombe, Mukele, Mukele on nights when clouds made way for the stars to shine. She would learn to chant Iyo kao, njama jama kao, yo mami go fungaundere foseka bele kao, o che. She would go to boarding school at the prestigious all-girls Saker Baptist College, where for 8 months a year she would be locked behind iron gates, hidden from boys, and made to study alongside girls destined to become doctors and engineers. In Limbe, Leomi and Timba would have many things they would not have had in America. But they would lose far too many things. They would lose the opportunity to grow up in a magnificent land of uninhibited dreamers. They would lose the chance to be awed and inspired by amazing things happening in the country. Incredible inventions and accomplishments by men and women who look like them. They would be deprived of freedoms, rights, and privileges that Cameroon could not give its children. They would lose unquantifiable benefits by leaving New York City, because while there existed great towns and cities all over the world, there was a certain kind of pleasure, a certain type of adventurous and audacious childhood that only New York City could offer a child. Chapter 59. Betty hosted a farewell party for them in the Bronx. Most of their friends, who had been with them from their arrival in the city, through Timba's birth and Pajonga's death, were there. Winston and Maami were there, as well as Olu and Tunde, the instructor who stopped by with his equally fine Asian boyfriend on the way to another party to hug Neni goodbye. And Fatu and Usman, whose broomstick legs Neni at once thought of the moment he walked through the door wearing faded mom jeans.
Imagining what they looked like forced her to smile her first real smile of the evening. Everyone came with something to eat. Fried ripe plantains, bitterleaf soup, egusi stew, cow feet and beans, poulet deje, grilled tilapia, acheke, moi moi, suya, jollof rice, curry chicken, pounded yams. Winston brought drinks, along with his laptop and speakers. In Betty's sparsely furnished living room, they ate and they danced to Petit Pays and Koffi Olomide, to Brenda Fassie and Papa Wemba. Then Mayway's 200% Zoblazo came over the speakers. Trumpets and keyboards sounded, calling all celebrators to the dance floor. The rhythm, fierce, pulsating, resolute, demanded that everyone get on their feet. Those who were eating put down their food. Those who were drinking put down their bottles. Ting, 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 ding, ding. Nenny moved to the center of the room. Her hips couldn't help swaying to music this good. Her feet couldn't stand still, even if she wasn't having the happiest day of her life. Everyone was up, packed in the 8x12 space at the center of the room. Arms raised in the air, the women rotated their buttocks, going harder and harder toward the floor, faster and faster as they rose up. Behind them, one arm around their waists, the men worked their crotches up, down, left, right, forward, backward, side to side. All around, buttocks and crotches moved in one accord, pressed against each other as the music soared. Then the chorus arrived. They jumped and skipped as they pumped their fists, singing together as loud as they could. Blazo, blazo, zo blazo, on a gagné, on a gagné. When one of Jende's non-African friends from work asked him what the song meant, he shouted without pausing to catch his breath, "It means we have won, man. It means we have won." Judson Memorial Church bade them farewell, too. Natasha asked Nani if Jende could come with her to church on the second Sunday of August. Jende agreed. It seemed a good time to visit an American church and see if Americans interpreted the Bible the same way as Cameroonians. The scripture that morning was from Genesis 18, the story of the weary visitors who visited Abraham and Abraham, not knowing they were angels, treated them with kindness. Natasha preached about the treatment of weary strangers in America. She decried the contemporary American definition of weary stranger as illegal alien. "Remember when we welcomed our visitors at Ellis Island with lunchboxes?" she asked to loud applause. "And a free doctor's checkup," someone in the back shouted. The church roared. Natasha smiled as she watched her congregants whispering among themselves. "Sad," she said, shaking her head. "Treating our friends in need of help the way we treat our enemies. Forgetting that we could find ourselves in search of a home someday too. This bears no resemblance to the love the Bible speaks of, the love Jesus Christ preached about when he said we should love our neighbor as ourselves." Before ending the sermon, Natasha called the Jongas to the front of the church. "This is the Jonga family," she told the congregation. "In about a week, they'll be returning home to their native Cameroon. They came to America to stay, but we won't let them. They're returning home because they cannot get papers to remain in our country and create a better life for themselves and their children. They're returning because we as a country have forgotten how to welcome all kinds of strangers to our home." She paused and looked around, giving the congregation time to digest her words. She then turns to Nani and Jende, hugged them, and thanked them for sharing their story. Father, mother, son, and daughter returned to their seats with the eyes of the congregation following them. The assistant pastor, Amos, rose to speak after the sermon. "You've heard Natasha's sermon and you've met the Jongas," he said. "They're not strangers. They're our neighbors, but they cannot make their home among us. So I encourage you all to give generously to help them create a new home in their country. And while we give," he continued, "let's remember that there are many more out there like this couple. Worse still, there are many out there who do not have a warm, peaceful country to return to. There are many for whom the only chance at ever having a home again is in America." Nani and Jende looked at each other when Amos mentioned the money. Natasha had told them nothing about it, and this unexpected and kind gesture briefly misted Nani's eyes. The thought that she would be leaving behind a country abounding in institutions of tolerance and compassion. After the service, A line of congregants stood in front of them, taking turns to greet them. One woman wanted to know where Cameroon was on the map, and another wanted to know if Jende needed help finding a lawyer to continue his immigration case. He told the first woman that Cameroon was right next to Nigeria. To the second, he said no. He did not need a lawyer. His case was closed. Most congregants simply wanted to shake hands or wish them well or tell them how glad they were that the Jongas had shared their story. A teenage girl choked up while telling Jende of a friend's father who was deported to Guatemala, even though he knew no one there. Her friend was very sad now, the young woman said. Jende gave her a hug and told her that, thankfully, they still had many family and friends in Cameroon. Chapter 60. The email response came within 2 hours of Jende hitting the send button. Nice hearing from you, Jende, Clark wrote. I'm surprised to hear you're returning home, but I understand. Sometimes a man just has to go back home. You can certainly stop by to say goodbye. Talk to my secretary. Jende went to visit Clark wearing the same black suit he'd worn for his first day of work as Clark's chauffeur. Nenny had told him the suit was unnecessary, but he had insisted on wearing it. I'm going to be around people wearing suits, he reminded her. Why should I look like a nobody? When he walked in, Clark stood from behind his desk to greet him. It's very nice of you to come say goodbye, he said, smiling as he offered a hand. It's me who has to thank you for making the time, sir, Jende replied, taking Clark's hand into both of his. Clark seemed beyond pleased to see him, smiling more broadly than Jende had ever seen him smile, his eyes brighter than they had been in all the months Jende drove him around, his face younger looking. Jende could tell that Mr. Edwards' happiness was not merely from seeing him. His former boss finally seemed a genuinely happy man. I wanted to give my condolences for the death of Mrs. Edwards, sir, Jende said after they were seated. I was at the memorial service, sir, but I could not get an opportunity to get near you to tell you how sorry I was. Clark nodded. Jende looked around at the office he'd moved to since they last saw each other. It had neither a sofa nor a view of Central Park, but the view of Queens was special in its own inferior way. How's your family? Clark asked. Are they happy to be going back home? They are fine, sir. Thank you. My wife is angry, but she is not going to stay angry forever. My son is happy because I tell him about all the fun things I will take him to do back at home. The baby does not know anything, so that makes me happy. Are you happy? I am. But the more the day comes closer, the more I feel a little bit of sadness that I might never see this city again. New York is a wonderful city. It will be hard to not live here. Yeah, I'll have to learn to adjust too. I'll be leaving next month. Oh? You mean you are moving also, sir? Clark nodded. Mighty and I are moving to Virginia. Virginia? I found a new job in Washington, D.C. We're actually going to look at houses this weekend. I'm hoping we can find something close to Arlington and Falls Church.
Falls Church? I remember, sir. That is where Mrs. Edwards came from.
You've got a good memory. And my family lived in Arlington for a bit before we moved to Illinois. My parents will be moving from California so they can be close to us.
That will be very good for you, sir.
Family's everything, Clark said. I'm sure you know that already.
It is everything, sir.
I've got some cousins in the area, and Cindy has a half-sister there. Cindy wasn't close to her before the end, but she came to the funeral, and Mighty and I have been in touch with her lately.
That is good, sir.
Yeah. We had a great time visiting her a couple of months ago. Mighty's really looking forward to growing up with his cousins. It's important for him to know he has family now that... Well, now that so much has changed.
It is very true, sir, Jende said, nodding. Very true.
And how is Vince?
He's good. I spoke to him this morning.
He's thinking about opening a retreat center for American execs visiting Mumbai, so they can attain peace and quiet
between running around pursuing opportunities. Clark laughed. It sounded funny, but he might be onto something.
He is a very smart boy, sir, Jende said.
The executive smiled, his pride undisguised. Yeah, it's just hard for anyone to know where he's going to end up.
Maybe he'll end up in Limbe, Jende said, laughing.
Maybe, Clark said, laughing with him. You never know. He could go to Limbe and teach folks there how to be one with the universe and free themselves from their egos. Or he could have them walk around talking about rejecting the illusion.
Or maybe, sir, Jende said, laughing hard now, he could take them to the beach in the evening and they could watch the sun going down. The fishermen will be returning with their canoes on one side of the beach, and Vince and his followers will be sitting on the sand on the other side with their legs crossed, doing that chanting and meditation thing. I can almost picture that, Clark said, guffawing and slapping the table. I can completely see that happening.
He can stay with me and my wife until he gets tired of being in one place.
Oh, I'm sure he won't have a hard time finding a new place to go to.
He told me if his business idea doesn't work out in India, he might head to Bolivia.
Don't ask me what's in Bolivia.
Maybe a lot of mindful people, sir.
Maybe a lot of mindful people, Clark said, and they laughed together.
The boy is a very special young man, sir,
Jende said as their laughter died down.
Yeah, special is a good word.
If there were 10,000 more young men like him in this world, or even just 1,000, I swear, sir, there will be more happiness in the world.
Clark smiled. Jende shifted in his seat. He was enjoying his time with his old boss, but the new secretary had warned him that Clark had only 30 minutes for the meeting. He glanced at his watch. Not much time left. He had to quickly say what he'd come to say.
Sir, he began, I came here not only to say goodbye, but also to personally thank you for the job you gave me. You may not understand how it changed my life, but because of that job, I was able to save money, and now I can go back home to live well. Even though I would have liked to continue working for you and stay in America longer, I am happy that I can now go home and live a better life than the life I lived before I came to America. So I am just very thankful, sir.
Clark shifted in his seat and rubbed his eyes with his palms.
Wow,
he said. It was apparent no one had ever traveled so far to thank him for doing nothing more than pay for a service. His desk phone rang, but he didn't pick it up.
I hear all these things that people are saying about Wall Street people, sir, about how they are bad people. But I don't agree with them, because it was you, a Wall Street man, who gave me a job that helped me to take care of my family. And you were very nice to me. I think you are a good man, Mr. Edwards, and that is why I came to thank you.
Clark Edwards stared at his former chauffeur, clearly thinking of the best words to convey his surprise at what he was hearing.
I'm very touched, Jende, he said.
Really?
And I thank you, too.
It was a great experience for me having you.
Quite a thrill many times, actually. And if I never said it, I hope you know how much I appreciated your loyalty and dedication.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm sorry, Jende.
No, please, Mr. Edwards, don't be sorry.
For what?
That our time together had to end. I'm not sure how to put it, but it's a pity, you know?
Jende shook his head.
Our people say no condition is permanent, Mr. Edwards. Good times must come to an end just like bad times, whether we want it or not.
Indeed, Clark said. I'm just glad we can part as friends.
I am also glad, sir,
Jende said, nodding as he pushed his chair back and stood up. Clark stood up too, and the men shook hands, the streets of New York on which they once drove together visible through the window beside them.
Do pass on my regards to Nenny, Clark said.
I will, sir,
Please tell Mighty that me and Nenny send him special greetings.
Will do. He was very fond of you guys. You may not have realized it, but your presence in his life really did impact him a great deal. He still tells me, Jende said this, Nenny did that. We think about him also, especially after Mrs. Edwards died. I thought sometimes about maybe I should call you and try to see him, but me and my wife, we had so many troubles going on that I did not even have time to do a lot of things I wanted to do. But we don't forget him. He's a good boy. He is. I'm glad he's looking forward to moving to Virginia. If he didn't want to go, I would have passed on the opportunity, even though it's something I've wanted to do for a long time. Barclays is transferring you to work in another office in D.C., sir? No. I'll be starting a whole new job. Heading a lobbying firm. Jende moved his hand to scratch his head. It's a firm that lobbies to protect the interests of organizations, Clark said. I'll be heading one that lobbies for credit unions. The work's going to be very important in this economic climate. Very exciting opportunity for me.
It sounds like it is a different kind of work, sir.
It is. Wall Street's been good to me, but I don't think there's room for the likes of me here anymore. Besides, with everything that's happened, I'm ready for a change.
I am very glad, sir, Jende said, smiling. I hope you have success with the lobbying.
Thank you, Clark said, smiling back. I hope so, too. By the way, Jende, Clark called as Jende began walking toward the door. I forgot to ask you. Why are you going back home?
Jende did not need time to think about the best answer.
He immediately turned around, walked back to the desk, and told the truth.
My application for asylum was not approved, sir.
Asylum? I had no idea you were applying for asylum.
I never mentioned it to you, sir. It is something which I kept between me and my wife and my lawyer. I did not think I should bother you with something like that.
No, of course I understand. I'm just surprised. What does it mean it was not approved? Are you being deported?
No, sir. I'm not being deported. But I cannot get a green card unless I am granted asylum, and for that to happen, I will have to spend many years and a lot of money going to immigration court. And then maybe the judge will still decide to not give me asylum, which means the government will deport me in the end. It's not how I want to live my life, sir. Especially when you add the fact that it's just not easy for a man to enjoy his life in this country if he is poor.
But isn't there some other way you can try to get a green card? Clark said, after picking up his ringing phone and telling the person on the line he would call back. I know how badly you wanted to raise your children here.
I did what I could, sir, but
surely there has to be a way to keep a decent, hard-working man like you in America.
Jende shook his head. There are laws, sir, he said.
Listen, Clark said, sitting up. I've got a good friend from Stanford who's an associate director at immigration. If you had told me you had a case, I would have contacted him for you to get advice. Or at least ask for a recommendation for an excellent lawyer. I had no idea.
Jende looked down and shook his head, a rueful smile on his face.
It might not be too late, Clark went on. Maybe you could reschedule your flight. Give me some time to contact my friend and see if we can still help you.
I think it's too late, sir.
But there's no harm in trying, is there?
The judge will not allow it, sir. And even if he did,
you're ready to leave.
Jende smiled. The truth, sir, he said, is that my body may still be here, but my heart has already gone back home. It is true, I came here to escape a hard life, and I did not want to go back. But when I had no choice but to go back, I found myself happy thinking about home, sir. I will miss America, but it will be good to live in my own country again. I already picture myself going to visit my father's grave to show him my daughter. I see myself walking around Limbe with my friends, getting a drink, taking my son to the stadium. I am no longer afraid of my country the way I used to be.
But what about the children?
They will be fine, sir.
We already have my daughter's American passport.